Well, this is the X8 session. The 50th anniversary of the prediction of superfluidity of helium-3. We have five speakers. The session is sponsored by the Forum on the History of Physics. And it's just being recorded. We are going to put it on our web, the Forum for the History of Physics. And we would appreciate, if you are not already a member of it, if you would subscribe to it so that we have a larger say in the family of the American Physical Society. We will start the session with the first speaker, who is Philip Anderson, Superconductivity with Very Repulsive Interactions, Helium-3, Pierre Morel, and Me. Now, this will celebrate, or this session does celebrate, the two papers by Bruckner, Anderson,
Soda,
Morel,
and Soda,
as well as that by Emery and Sessler, which came out on the same year. Professor Anderson, please.
Thank you very much. I don't have many slides, but some of them are very nostalgic, and so I hope you will bear with them. In 1959, David Pines decided to move from his assistant professorship in the physics department of Princeton to the University of Illinois. He was sure that his field of many-body physics would be more appreciated, and that he and Gordon Boehm and John Bardeen could form a very strong group in that field. At Princeton, he had to leave behind the second of his brilliant French graduate students. The first one had been Philippe Nozière, and Philippe had finished and written a book with David, and he now recommended his very close friend Pierre Morel. I'm not sure, I think this was, well, I don't know exactly what this meant. Actually, Philippe and Pierre had been in serious competition for the same lady, and Pierre had won. And I guess what Philippe wanted to do was to get them both out of France. Perhaps, we don't know. Anyhow, Philippe was also employed as a science attaché by the French consulate in New York and couldn't follow David to Illinois. So David bequeathed him to me. Now, David has done me very many quite great favors in the course of a long association. But this probably was the greatest, because it turns out that Pierre also, and like Philippe, was a remarkable young man. Socially, Pierre was a little rich for my blood. One of the most vivid memories I have of him and the beautiful girl that Philippe didn't get was that they came and saw us off one time when we were flying off to England, 1961, I believe it was. And for various reasons, Joyce and I had chosen the most cut-rate flight that we possibly could get, namely Iceland Air. And so here came the two of them with this great big bouquet of seeing off flowers, and we got into this tiny little plane and went off toward Reykjavik. But physics-wise, Pierre was very much what I needed. He was extremely able mathematically, yet he was not, as one might have feared, too much enamored of his own ideas. I had a problem already for him. This was the possibility of exotic BCS-like states having pairs with finite angular momentum, and thus with anisotropic energy gaps, which I had scribbled down in a notebook a few months previously. If you really need to know, March 24th, 1959 is the date that I found in my notebook, it's pretty clear that this is one of those ideas whose time had come. It broke out independently all over the place, and I don't think priority for it is very meaningful. In fact, the earliest publication of the idea was in Russian in the JETP in 1959 by Lev Pidiyevsky. Maybe if I can... The earliest publication was in Russian in JETP, 1959. It played relatively little role in the subsequent history because none of us read it. I don't know, maybe Andy did, but I didn't. Actually, even Pidiyevsky doesn't claim credit for the basic idea. He, in turn, ascribes it to a casual remark by Landau. The Russians, of course, the Russians were from the first focusing on helium-3, and Pidiyevsky's paper spends most of its very considerable length proving that if you get to large enough L, interaction will be attractive, and therefore you will have a paired state in helium-3. And I believe that is, in fact, actually true. But it didn't end up being terribly relevant to the whole thing. In the West, one independent source of the idea was David Thallus, who writes about it as a small part of an enormous Annals of Physics review of BCS in 1960. He also mentions finite L casually in his 1961 book, which was also completed in 1960. But David, like me at first, was unfamiliar with helium-3 and never mentions that as a possibility. Although I referenced David in my early papers, I, like I'm fairly sure all the others involved, was totally independent. My stimulus was that I had visited the General Electric Laboratories in February 1959, and I'd heard a clumsy attempt at an anisotropic gap by a metallurgist named John Fisher, and my notebook contained how it really should have been done. I learned about helium-3 in the summer of 1959 from our summer visitor to Bell Labs, Keith Bruckner, to whom I had given an explanation of my ideas on anisotropic gaps. And Bruckner, being from the nuclear physics world and knowing that our supply of helium-3 was growing by leaps and bounds, was immediately realized that the anisotropic gap might apply in that case. I was a bit shocked to receive less than 2 months after this conversation a full-fledged paper from Keith and his graduate student, Toshio Soda, in which he proposed not only an anisotropic state for helium-3, but also a number of anisotropic states for nuclear matter. Since he'd had no idea such states were possible before talking to me, I thought that seemed a bit much. I would normally, in fact, however, have let it pass. But you must realize that this was my first ever graduate student, and I was fiercely protective of Pierre. Keith was very nice about it when I phoned him and added our names as co-authors without any hesitation. Keith, I suspect, had gotten word that Emery and Sessler were hard at work on similar ideas and hot on our tail, and Keith was in a hurry. His submission date was January 1960. Theirs was a few weeks later. In the event, of course, we were all far behind Pitievsky, and it didn't matter. It is noteworthy that Emery and Sessler also attribute the basic idea of finite L to someone else, namely, yet another source, Ben Mottelson. And I just talked to David a few moments ago and discovered that he also had discussed it with Ben Mottelson. So, in fact, none of the people involved in the papers really had the idea originally. Bruckner and Soda had one basic idea that was good and is central to the BCS theory in general. This goes back to the Bogoyubov concept that the BCS equation is a resummation of the ladder diagrams for scattering of quasi-particles near the Fermi surface. One can almost exactly sum up all of the high-energy scattering and be left with a potential which is valid in a thin shell near the Fermi surface, and that potential near the Fermi surface can be expanded in Legendre polynomials or whatever is the useful representation. The TC, once you have the Legendre polynomial expansion of the potential, TC turns out to be determined by a linear equation. Not everything is determined, but the TC is in fact exactly determined by a linear equation within the BCS theory. And the potential separates out exactly into the separate angular momenta, or in case you have something more complicated like a crystal, the separate representations of the point group of the crystal. And that in turn is all determined by the phase shift for the scattering at that particular angular momentum. They calculated this phase shift for different angular momenta L, and they used simply the quite well-known interatomic potential, but they had to make very crude allowances in the BCS equation for the renormalization of the properties of the dense liquid surrounding the interacting atoms, and they came out with a transition temperature in the neighborhood of 0.15 degrees K, and at the time, it was already rather dubious whether that was low enough, and certainly within a year or so, the experimental temperature had been lowered well below that. I actually was myself dubious about claiming any particular transition temperature. What little was known at the time about helium-3, as well as your common sense, indicated that by any sensible measure, it was more strongly interacting by a lot than either typical metals or than nuclear matter. And I felt sure that there were large renormalizations of all of its properties, which many body theory was not yet capable of coping with. I was probably even underestimating the length of time it would take to do anything about the many body theory. Everything learned since then has confirmed this intuition. I think the last thing I heard was from two of the greatest experts in the field was that it's still not possible from first principles to predict whether it will be L equals 1 or L equals 2, whether it will be triplet or singlet. So my instinct was okay, but it was a counsel of futility. What I thought was worthwhile in what we were doing was to establish matters of principle. were such a state to occur, and what would be its properties? From here on, I will concentrate on our own papers, which were completely focused on these questions, not on supposedly realistic estimates of TC. And the papers that I'm going to be talking about are the Physica 26 paper, the next Anderson and Morel PhysRev letter, and finally the last paper, the Anderson and Morel in PhysRev 1961. I took what I saw as an extremely bold step and chose to give my talk at the International Congress in Utrecht in June 1960 on this very speculative topic. Very good. At that conference, there appears to have been a lot of discussion among various people, David Thallus, Victor Galitsky, and myself. And indeed, in the official photograph, although you probably won't recognize it, this is me, and next to me is Galitsky, and on the other side of Galitsky is Jerry Brown, who was told me, in fact, about the existence of both Thallus and Galitsky initially. My paper, which was sent in July 1960, acknowledges Thallus and Galitsky. It's published in the Proceedings in Physica, Volume 26. And I pointed that out. Pierre and I also submitted a joint PhysRev letter in July, and believe it or not, in those far-off days, it appeared in August, less than a month hence. And Erratum corrected a few, not all, egregious errors, as you will learn. And finally, Pierre and I published a full and much more polished paper in Physical Review the next year, which was mostly on a possible L equals 2 state, but mentioned in passing the possibility of L equals 1, S equals 1. Incidentally, you'll probably recognize a few of these people. There's T.D. Lee, there's Harry Sewell, there's Leon Van Hove, there's David Pines himself. There's Green. Well, it's not a very clear photograph, but on the next slide, actually, I have my crib sheet for it, which you also probably can't read, which gives you the names. Oh, there's Bogoliubov. I forgot to point out Bogoliubov right here. And this was the second time he had been let out of the Soviet Union. He was too eminent to get out very much. Galitsky, over sitting next to me, had come out several times. This is Bill Fairbank. Is that Karinga, or is it Karinga over here somewhere? There's Dome. Anyhow, it was my first real international congress, to which I was not a supernumerary, and I felt it was very, very daring to talk about a totally conjectural state that might appear in something like helium-3. The question was, were these anisotropic states real superconductors? At the time, what was accepted was Landau's criterion for superconductivity or superfluidity, which was the statement that there were no excitations which had a velocity less than some minimum, or that all the excitations must have a gap. Many of these states were gapless in that the gap has zeros, and the zeros are separated by large momentum increments, and so the excitations had finite velocities. Now, they were indeed super. This was very enlightening as to the nature of superfluidity. I still find Landau's criterion quoted in books, but it became meaningless in 1959. Of course, the next year or two, there came out the concept of gapless superconductors, and it became even more obvious that the criterion was meaningless. Also, the second thing that was true of these states was that there turned out to be a number of different states for any given L and S, all with the same energy, same TC, because the equation for TC is linear, but with different free energies. How did they choose among them? What was the criterion for which L equals 1, M equals 1, L equals 0, M equals 0, or L equals 1, M equals 0, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? What was the meaning of the apparent possibility of orbital ferromagnetism, and how would it manifest itself? In what sense would the system exhibit anisotropy? All these questions had to wait for their final solution until we had the real stuff at hand, but we began to ask them at least. First of these questions, as I said, was superconductivity or superfluidity. Apparently, Landau hung on rather desperately to his early contention that superfluidity was not related to quantum statistics, demonstrating that even great geniuses are perfectly capable of holding two incompatible opinions simultaneously. After all, he was also the author of Landau-Ginzburg with its complex order parameter, which gave us all the properties of the superconductors. We used as our criterion for superness the Meissner effect, or equivalently for a neutral fluid, the Andronic-Keshvili effect for superfluids. That superflow is curl-free and derived in curl-free current, and that derives from a coherent bosonic matter field. As for the multiple states, it's only very rarely, if at all, that BCS type of superconductivity exhibits a phase diagram with any complexity to it. We recognized them from the first that a distinguishing feature of the anisotropic superconductors would be that whereas a BCS superconductor has the symmetry of the identity representation gamma naught of the rotation group or of the point group of the crystal substrate, which is, and that the gamma naught is necessarily non-degenerate, the anisotropic superconductors will characteristically belong to degenerate representations, breaking the point group symmetry in several possible ways. At the transition point, the equation determining TC is linear, and thus all linear superpositions of these solutions have the same TCs. But any nonlinear effects distinguish among the substates. The solutions may and usually will also be complex, breaking time reversal as well as the point group symmetry. As far as collective modes are concerned, I guess I didn't mention that in my list of questions, but apparently stimulated to some extent by Galitsky, I did think to mention collective modes and to mention that because the state was anisotropic, they would involve interesting and complicated effects. I had no idea what a big role collective modes would play in the identification and understanding of the real thing, helium-3 itself, but at least I didn't leave them out. In the early papers, the only solutions we looked at were the individual YLMs for M equals 0 to L. We pointed out that complete decoupling of the only different Ls was only valid right at TC, but that, in fact, it was still a very good approximation because the effect of cross-couplings wouldn't be small if gaps were small compared to Fermi energies, as we supposed was true. So one can calculate relative energies of the different substates very well. The basic criterion is that the gap should cover the Fermi surface as completely as possible. Of course, that favors complex gaps because they have only point zeros, whereas real YLMs have line zeros, a much higher density of points where they're zero. This, incidentally, is one of the most important mysteries of modern cuprate physics, namely, why is the gap real? The answer actually says a lot about cuprate physics, and that and is very seldom either remarked upon or understood. At first, calculations seem to favor the orbital ferromagnets with gap functions like sine theta e to the im phi. So we thought about total angular momentum, or more generally, what did a complex order parameter do? I still like our solution of that dilemma, and which was to show that there are easily calculable correlations between n of r and n of r prime. Namely, there's a little bump of extra electron amplitude around one electron, which is caused by the fact that there that the other electron that the electron another electron is paired with it. But what we discovered or pointed out was that in these states there was also a correlation n of r, a number at this point, times the current at that point, j of r prime. But these correlations can be shown not to contribute any bulk current, but they imply a small surface current of order the gap over the Fermi energy, which in turn implies a small angular momentum. Most of the rest of the discussion in those early papers was much too restricted as to the variety of possible states discussed, as we were to be made to discover later. But I think we were the first to point out that the general phase diagram structure with the overall TC the same or similar, but the possibility of a number of substates breaking the point group symmetry in a number of different ways was absolutely characteristic and diagnostic of this form of superconductivity. In these papers, we also pointed out a second diagnostic for these states, that in contrast to BCS superconductivity, TC would be expected to be as sensitive to ordinary scattering as BCS. How many? A few seconds or 2 minutes. I'm fairly close. This, of course, is to no help in the case of helium-3, since nothing dissolves in it and there are no impurities. In one of the papers, incidentally, I made the solecism of stating that helium-4 does dissolve, which is untrue. On the other hand, for some years after the discovery of heavy electron superconductors, which passed both of these criteria, as well as others also theoretically based, the conventional wisdom seemed to be that nonetheless it was far too radical to accept that they were of this exotic, unfamiliar, non-BCS class. Nowadays, this unfortunate prejudice has evaporated, perhaps in the face of the cuprates, and it's possible to suggest, as I have, that there may in reality be more BCS, non-BCS, than BCS superconductors in the universe somewhere. The third paper with Pierre Morel was a much more serious and thoughtful effort suitable to be part of his thesis. There's a thorough treatment of the pseudopotential idea and of the simplification of the potential. Here we mainly focused on possible D states, since at the time most people believed that L equals 1 could not avoid the hardcore repulsion sufficiently to be attractive. We discovered that the lowest energy state we could find is a complex superposition of m equals 0 and m equals plus or minus 2, which breaks the rotational symmetry down to a representation of the group of a cube and gives an energy gap magnitude of cubic symmetry. It does, however, break time reversal symmetry, and there would be, there would be circulating surface currents, although not such as to lead to a net orbital angular momentum. In passing, we carried along also the L equals 1 possibility, which was also complex and did have a net angular momentum. We did not mention explicitly that the susceptibility for the L equals 1 Anderson-Morrill angular momentum state would be constant through TC, which is obvious, but we did plot the D wave susceptibility and showed that it wasn't constant through TC. We also made a quantitative estimate of inelastic scattering effects on TC using what was by now the known real data on helium-3, and we concluded that the transition couldn't occur above 20 millidegrees, although we didn't know how far below that it might be, and that the original estimate of 150 millidegrees had indeed been over-optimistic. This paper is, to my knowledge, the first to deal in some detail with the really complex questions of multiple symmetry breaking. We took the problem seriously and we found some meat in it. Of course, we made one serious mistake, which Roger Balian and Dick Wertheimer fixed, and we made one serious omission, which are the Fermi liquid corrections, which Tony Leggett supplied. And when the real-life helium-3 appeared, it turned out that there was much more to do. But we feel we made a brave start. Thank you.